Went back overseas, went to Afghanistan that summer, brought a couple footballs with me. Any downtime I had, just like in the prior deployment to Iraq, I was training, you know, and I was long snapping like at least 30 minutes a day, if not more. Started to get the spiral down, started to get the accuracy down, trying to work on my velocity. That was the biggest issue. Came back, you know, went to in preseason training camp, and I won the backup job. So first game of the year, I'm the backup. And they had recruited a kid to come in and do it, you know, and he was a freshman. And, you know, there's 101,000 people. He's like more than that now. But at the time, there's 101,000 people in Texas Memorial Stadium. It's nerve-wracking, and, you know, and he didn't have a great first game. And so I got an opportunity the next week and started for 38 straight games after that until I graduated.
Welcome to What's Next with Eric Wood, where we will prepare you to make your what's next in life your best yet. Our next guest is Nate Boyer. And Nate is an absolute Renaissance man. The former active duty Green Beret is also a world traveler, a philanthropist and community leader, and a professional athlete as a member of the Seattle Seahawks. Nate is the co-founder of the organization Merging Vets and Players, which has helped countless individuals transition out of professional sports and the military. He's also the director of the new movie, MVP, which is available in all 30 NFL markets and will be on streaming services. This is an episode of the podcast you will undoubtedly grow from in your journey in life. And if you haven't already, please rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you tune in weekly. And also, if you haven't already, please go to Amazon and order my new book, Tackle What's Next, which hits on a lot of the same topics we will discuss on this podcast today. And the link to that is in the show notes. Thanks. And enjoy. Nate, welcome to the show, brother.
Thanks so much, Eric. I appreciate that. It said Seattle Seahawks, former Seattle Seahawks, and it was very brief. Just we got to make that clear.
You know? Hey, it's all good. You were a member of the organization. You are a former professional athlete. That leads you to be able to speak into so much of what you do now, understanding that transition out of military and being affiliated with pro sports. So I don't want to undermine you there. That's okay. You don't have to preface that on here. I'm building you up. This is about you. If it was the other way around, maybe we'd have some fun with it. But we actually got to meet, which you just reminded me of, while you were training Joe Jonas in the University of Louisville weight room. What was it like training Joe? You go from military, athletics, to training a superstar that's on a world tour performing. What was that like?
Well, that was short-lived as well, and not for any bad reason. But so, you know, I as you mentioned, you know, I was in the Army, did that for like 10 years, went and played college football briefly with the Seahawks, got done with that. And around that time, you know, become really good friends with Jay Glazer. We co-found MVP, Merging Vets and Players, which we'll get into later. But Jay has a gym in LA where that's where we started the organization. And he trains a lot of current athletes, former athletes, entertainers, people that just want to train around these people, you know, and kind of be around sort of elite folks in their respective fields. And at Unbreakable Performance Center, it's a fight gym, and it's just a hodgepodge of some really interesting characters and people from, you know, it's in the middle of West Hollywood, right?
Right.
So Joe had been training there for a while. I come back from Seattle, and you know, now I'm like trying to strip all the weight off and get rid of the football weight. So I'm like getting after it, and Joe's getting ready to do this tour. So he's trying to get all shredded up, you know, he's got to look good on stage and everything. And Jay just kind of linked us up, and we kind of picked the same time slot to come in every day and work out. It just worked out for our schedule. So we ended up training together a bunch. So then Joe's getting ready to go on the road, and he's got, you know, his whole team, he's got personal trainers, he's got nutritionists, he's got the whole thing. But for whatever reason, there was like a 2-week gap in there where he needed somebody to fill in. And Jay was like, what about Nate? And he was like, you think he'd do it? And he's like, I don't know. I mean, you're going to pay him, right? He's like, yeah, of course. So Jay hit me up and was like, hey, what are you doing, you know, these 2 weeks? And I was like, nah, I have no plans. And he's like, why don't you do this? So it was cool because we went all these cities we went to that had either a university or a professional sports stadium somewhere that I had a connection with, we would just go train there. And Joe loved it. He's a big sports fan. So, you know, he had his concert in, for instance, he had his, one of his shows was in Dallas where the Mavericks play, you know, in that arena. And I got in touch with the strength guy there. So like we're in the Maverick strength room, strength conditioning room, and on one of their practice courts doing some drills and having fun. When we were in Austin, obviously I played at UT, so I had the connection to get in the weight room there. Brandon Roberts, I don't know if you remember Brandon Roberts. Yeah. Brandon Roberts was at UT at the time. He was at Louisville prior. Now he's down in South Florida. He was like, you know, I know a guy, Joe Midday up in Louisville. Let me hook you up with him. And so we go out there and I was like, Joe, you want to go train at the University of Louisville football weight room? And he was just like, that'd be awesome. So we go down there and train. And then, yeah, you're in there getting after it. And I was like, that dude looks familiar. And, you know, we all just kind of met at that time. Cause you were already playing with the Bills at the time and just there in the off season. So, yeah. And that was like about 6 years ago, you know,
I'm impressed with as many people as, you know, as much as you travel, you remember people's names like that. That's an incredible way of honoring people, but to throw out those names right there on command, we did not talk about that prior, you know, it wasn't in the email that Darryl from my team sent over. That was impressive there, but you mentioned a lot there and I want to just backtrack. I love having former military guys on. You're kind of the sweet spot for me. You've transitioned out of a lot of things and we'll get to a lot of that, but after high school, you move out to Hollywood to potentially be an actor, but life had a different plan for you and you end up joining the military and becoming a Green Beret. What led you to join the military?
Yeah, so right after high, I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. So I was born in Tennessee, but I grew up in California. So I'm pretty much, you know, I've been a Californian most of my life. After high school, no idea what I wanted to do. College didn't seem like it was something I was prepared for. I mean, honestly, I just wasn't. And I didn't really know, I didn't have any scholarship offers for sports or anything. So I moved to San Diego. I worked on a fishing boat. I took some firefighting classes. Thought maybe I wanted to do that, which is an extremely honorable job and something I would actually love to do. But I was 18 years old and I wasn't ready to grow up. You know what I mean? I wasn't ready to make that. That's a big commitment. I mean, you not only do you have people's lives in your hands, but that's a career. I mean, I could potentially get on one of the stations there at 20, 21 years old, but you don't do that for like a year or two, you know, and just kind of try something else. You're a firefighter. So I backed off of taking the classes there and moved up to LA because I was interested in film and TV at the time. There was, storytelling is something that I never really thought I would be into growing up in high school. I didn't take theater, wasn't like a child actor or anything like that. Like it was just not on my radar at all. And not my parents either. My dad is a racehorse veterinarian and my mom's an engineer. So like not entertainment is just not in our family tree. But I was just so interested in it. I move up there, I start taking some acting classes, thinking about film school. And then the next year when I was 20 years old, 9/11 happens. And, you know, I didn't join the military right away. Kind of wish I would have, because I think I was in there. It would have been, we talk about regrets and wish I would have done that then or whatever. Can't change it. I don't regret the way things have happened, but I did sort of flounder there for about 3 years before I actually signed up and just trying to figure out who I was and find myself. And I never really did, you know what I mean? But I did end up doing, right before I joined the military, I ended up doing some relief work in Africa. In 2004, when there was this, you know, this genocide going on in the Darfur region of Sudan. And, I went over there for a couple of months and volunteered and the people there just completely changed my life, changed my, perspective of a lot of things. I think it absolutely challenged my preconceived notions of how people viewed America and Americans, especially in these developing countries that are pretty war-torn. I think in the media and the news, we always see this negative reflection of how people view America and Americans. Right. And it's not exactly accurate. You know, I know we're not perfect and the ugly American traveler, I mean, it's a thing, but I think the idea of what we have here and the possibility that we have here and as imperfect as we still are, the ability to exercise a lot of the freedoms that we do exercise and, you know, how less corrupt we are than a lot of places is inspiring to people. And these people over there just wanted to hear about America, you know? And I honestly like gained my patriotism over there. Not that I was unpatriotic, but I think I just took a lot for granted. And I just became so appreciative of what we have, but also what we fight for in other places for other people. Even if we don't succeed sometimes, we're willing to go do that. And a lot of men and women for hundreds of years have been willing to just leave whatever they have and go do something. I wasn't leaving much. I'll say that. Like when I did go sign up, I didn't have a lot going on back here. And it was this idea of like being a part of something bigger than me and a sense of purpose and all that. So I joined the Army and decided I wanted to become a Green Beret because the motto for the Special Forces was De Oppresso Liber, which means to free the oppressed. And that really just resonated with me, especially after seeing that level of oppression in a place like Sudan and Chad. And so, yeah, I came back and signed up like kind of right away. Quick story at the end of this, trip to Africa, I got malaria my last week there. His family took care of me, nursed me back to health. And they put this little radio in the bed next to me or in the bedroom, like I was sleeping on this cot, but they had this like separate room for me where I could quarantine. And the only station that came through on the radio was the BBC News. And the Second Battle of Fallujah, which is one of the biggest battles in the global war on terror, was going on. And I was hearing like this play-by-play, essentially of mostly Marines that were going in there and, doing what they could to get people out and to take the city back and sort of turn the tide of the war early on. And these people, they're mostly 19-year-old kids that they don't have a connection to Iraq or Afghanistan or anything like that. They're just doing it because they want to fight for the ideals, you know, that the military and the country is supposed to be representing and all that. And so it just kind of inspired me. And I was like, man, I'm going to go do that. There's so many people that are willing to do it. And like I said, I don't have a ton going on back home. So once I got healed up, I flew back and pretty much went straight to the recruiter and off I went.
Wow. What a story. I appreciate your willingness to try multiple things. I feel like so many people nowadays are just so afraid to fail that they don't give anything a shot. And then they kind of float through this life without a whole lot of purpose or meaning because they're just so afraid that either I don't know enough or I'm too afraid to fail in those situations. I appreciate your service. I appreciate your willingness to serve the country. And, you know, I think you said it perfectly, like this country is not perfect, but this is the land of opportunity for so many out there. And we take it for granted. If you haven't been outside of this country and you got to experience how impoverished so much of the world is and how much we just live with and take for granted. I appreciate your willingness to protect that, but I got to know, I love asking this to whether it's been SEALs or Special Forces members. How tough was Q school and what was the toughest part for you individually? Because I feel like there's different aspects that are toughest for each individual.
Yeah. So in the Army, basically the path is if you're already in the Army, if you're in a conventional unit, you apply for Special Forces and you go to Special Forces selection, right? If you're like me and coming in off the street, there was a new program called the 18 X-ray program that opened, I believe, in 2003. And so I was, you know, coming like a year after that when I signed up, and you would come in off the street and you go to basic training and you go to airborne school and then you go to a pre-selection course. It was called SOPC, Special Operations Preparatory Course. And it was it was actually longer than Special Forces selection. And to me, it was harder. And the reason they made it harder is because the last thing they wanted was somebody that passed all these tests, you know, and got this contract, but then to come in only to quit halfway through Special Forces training and they waste all this, you know, they're investing in you.
Right.
I heard different numbers at different times, but you know, it costs upwards of $1 million, you know, to put somebody through all of that, you know, 2 years of very intense, highly sophisticated, the best training you can get in the world. Like they need to get their money's worth out of you as a warfighter, you know what I mean? So they had this SOP C course. It was, we were sleeping in these old World War II barracks that I'm pretty sure were infested with something. And like every day you're out there, you know, heavy rucksack on your back, you know, rifle in your hand, wearing BDUs, walking around with a compass and a map, trying to find grid coordinates out in the woods. You know what I mean?
Wow.
And it's simple in its purest form, but you're tired, you're hungry, you're super, you know, you're always sore and injured and kind of limping through it. And you're, half the stuff happens in the middle of the night where you can't see anything. You can't use your lights. You can't use the roads. You know, you gotta like, it's cool. It is cool. Like it's very much, because most of what we do as in sports, team sports anyway, you do it together. You know what I mean? This is one of those things they want to make sure you can handle on your own. So I think that SOP C course of all of the, you know, 2 years of training from basic training until, you know, Robin Sage is what they call our final field exercise. That was probably the toughest, but I think it was intended to be at least the most physically demanding. And I'm not sure what that phrase is, but you had to be a self-starter. Like it's got to be on you. You know what I mean? Like you have to be individually motivated to go do that. And a lot of people quit. I mean, most of the people that didn't make it through, it was their choice. You know, they said they rang the bell and were like, and that's okay. You know, but it was like, I think that, yeah, that was the intent of the Army. And for me, it was like, it's not that I'm not one of those people that say like, well, quitting was never an option, because it ran through my head every day. You know, like you don't have to do this. It's okay. You can go to another Army unit and you're still going to be, you know, you're still going to kick butt, do some great things. Like there's nothing wrong with that. But then there'd be the other, you know, that's the devil on one shoulder. And I got the angel on the other shoulder telling you like, yeah, but if you just take one more step and then just take another one, and then the sun's going to start coming up in a bit and you're going to start feeling, you know, a little bit better and all of those kind of things, you know, you're kind of wrestling with that. And it's just so gratifying when you do finish just the day, each day, you know, like I didn't quit today. I got through it. And pretty soon, in a way, maybe quitting doesn't become an option anymore, because you're like, well, I did it before and that sucked and I made it. So I can do this, you know, maybe it seems a little harder, but I can do this. And I think that mentality, I know that mentality is the only reason I had the courage, I guess, to go try out for the Longhorns, you know, and go try and play college football. It all came from those days of just as much as I was struggling, you know, and not just me, I'm watching other people not quit. That's probably even a bigger part of it. I'm watching this other guy that's like, I think I'm in better shape than this dude. I'm more capable in my mind, but how is he like not only keeping up with me, like how am I behind this dude? You know what I mean? It's because there's something different about certain people. And those are the kind of people you want in the special forces. Those are the kind of people you want shoulder to shoulder with you on a football field. Like it's a certain type of person. And I don't know if it's some people are born with it or other people are just, they develop it. Or I think there's a lot of different ways that can be formed. You know what I mean? Cause I've met people that didn't have a lot of struggle in their life that still are like that. And I've met people that have gone through some incredible, you know, overcome some incredible obstacles. And I'm like, well, that makes sense. So it's just really interesting to me where that comes from. Cause I'm not exactly sure. But it's in me and it's in a lot of people.
I'm with you there. And we used to talk about guys in the NFL. Like if you had a fallback plan, if your dad had a family business, you're probably not going to make it through training camp. You're like, you're not going to be willing to sacrifice enough to make this team unless you have elite talent, if you have a fallback plan. And so, right. You know, we didn't know who those guys were, but we maybe get in talks with guys at the dinner table and, hey, what do you want to do after ball? Well, I got this insurance company I can go back to. Well, like you probably aren't making the team. Couple observations. One, it's so much easier to quit when you're by yourself because you're not letting those down around you. So I could see why that part of the training was by far the toughest. And we'll get to this in a little bit.
That's a good point. I haven't thought about that.
But why MVPs is so valuable now, because so many people that think that their best days are behind them or that's all their purpose was. If you're not in a community, it's so much easier to quit, you know, on things in life. And one last thing, Rob O'Neill was on the podcast and he talked about someone they had a commander that would tell them every day during SEAL training, he would tell them, look, people have done this before, just quit tomorrow. Like, don't quit today, just quit tomorrow. What we're going to ask you to do, somebody else has done. Like, I promise it can be done, just quit tomorrow. And he said that just got ingrained in him. So now when he does speaking gigs and whatnot, his big message is just quit tomorrow. Like, don't quit today, just quit tomorrow, which I thought was awesome. All right. So you mentioned that you went and played for the Longhorns, but you'd never played organized football in your life before. And I know from the firefighting to acting and everything else you got going, you're kind of a hop in with 2 feet type of guy. But what leads you to go into playing college football at the University of Texas? And you're 29 years old, I believe, when you get there. And so you're much older than the rest of your teammates. What was that like?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to touch on what you said real quick there. That is, I hadn't really thought about that, but the fact that it would have been a lot harder to quit had there been those guys around. Not, I think, for multiple reasons. One, like you said, you don't want to let them down, but also the shame. Like, they can see you. You know, they can watch you quit. When you're by yourself and no one watches you quit, you just pull up, you pull out your emergency phone, you know, emergency satellite phone or whatever. You make the call, they pick you up in the truck and they send you on your way. You don't have to see anybody. You go pack your bags quietly, you know, and disappear. So that's a good point. I mean, that I hadn't even thought of it in those terms, but it's so true. I was just thought of it in the terms of, like, you know, when you're alone on your own, you're just in your head a lot more and all that. But I think that's an interesting point.
Was that was that satellite phone like an old Zach Morris looking phone from Seattle?
I don't remember I know we had a GPS in there. Maybe we didn't have a phone. Maybe we had a little. You know what? We didn't. We had a card. Like a laminated card with like the phone number for the ops center. You got to find, because there's houses out there. I mean, you're out in the sticks, you go knock on somebody's door, you know, and make that call. Wow. Or you just kind of pull up and wait. And after the time limit's up, which you don't even know what the time limit is, but at some point it ends, they come with the GPSs. They'll come in on four wheelers and come pick everybody up, like the cadre. So,
and that's the other hardest thing too. No matter what you're doing in life, if you don't know when it's ending, that's the hardest part. That was the hardest part about COVID for so many people, because you didn't know when it was going to be over.
True. So
if you go out to a conditioning test and they say, hey, we're going to run 500 300-yard shuttles, that's fine. If they say, we're going to run 300-yard shuttles and we'll just let you know where we're going to stop, people inevitably start pacing themselves at the beginning and not going as hard. And then they're ultimately probably going to quit at some point, because they're going to say, well, we might do 10 more. I know I can't do 10 more, so I'll just quit now.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah. Or they just say, we're going to run.
Right.
dot.
Yeah.
Which they did. They would do that stuff, you know, and you never know the exact distance or the time standard, you know. So that's, you just go as hard as you can and fast as, you know, it's a weird balance, because you do, to your point, you do that, but you also are like, well, I have to also manage myself. And I mean, if I injure myself or completely exhaust myself and can't go on. So you're like riding that edge, which I think is a very, very similar to sports too. Like, you always want to, when you're training, when you're preparing, like, you're not maxing out all the time, but you need to be building muscle, building speed, building strength, building endurance, whatever it is. So you're kind of riding that edge of like, what is not the hardest thing, you know, in this one rep maybe, but like, what's the most bang for my buck, where I'm gaining, you know, repetitions, but also like I'm adding weight and making it tougher. Like, that's same kind of thing. You're just like always riding that edge of like, yeah, don't want to get hurt. Don't want to overexert or whatever, but I have to push. I have to push every day, 'cause there's somebody back there chasing me and I don't know how far they are, you know, but I don't want to find out.
So, yeah. All right. Well, we have a ton that I still want to get into, but I do want you to briefly touch on your time with the Texas Longhorns.
Yeah.
So you didn't play organized football. You go to the University of Texas. Talk about your time there, your interactions with much younger teammates that are kind of at a different stage of life than you, but talk about that experience.
Yeah. So I was in Iraq when I made the decision to go to college and to play. Like, I'd thought for maybe a year or so before that I was ready to go to school, right? Finally ready. I'm in my late 20s and I finally feel like I'm ready to go. Iraq was kind of winding down, so to speak. And, you know, whenever we had free time, you know, we'd fill it up with usually with like training, exercise, and something like that. You know, some guys play Call of Duty or whatever. Well, when football season rolled around, I started watching games like crazy. I just got like super, like kind of rehooked on football, especially college football. I always loved it. It was always my favorite sport. Didn't play growing up, as you mentioned. But it was just, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to play. I kind of regretted never doing it, never trying it. And I'm watching these games, and you know, you're watching a Monday night football game at 5 a.m. because we're 9 hours ahead in Iraq or Afghanistan or whatever. And so I'm up watching the game. We come back from a mission. I turn the game on, you know, stay up until whatever it is, maybe get a little bit of sleep and then get up and start training. And I sort of started dreaming about it, not literally like daydreaming about it. Man, if I go to school, I might as well just try out for the football team. Like, why not? You know, it's just going to school won't be enough anyway. I'll need more. I'm just that kind of person. I like a lot going on and I love challenges, you know? And so I made the decision to go to University of Texas because multiple reasons. I loved Austin. It's a great city, but also it's a great school and it's got, you know, this historic football tradition. It's sort of the biggest brand in college football. I mean, it really is, you know, at least if you look at the financials of it, like it really is. They have quite a reach, even when we're not good. And when I was there, we were okay. You know what I mean? Like we went to bowl games, but we weren't competing for a conference or national championships or anything. And so I started training over there. I started trying to teach myself how to backpedal, like running routes in the sand, like, you know, training different, trying to put on weight. Cause I was like 165 pounds.
Wow.
In the middle of that deployment when I made the decision. So, not that I got huge. I mean, I got up to 175 before I came home, you know what I mean? But I came back and I applied to UT. I got in. It was the only place I applied. Found out that I was accepted when I was over in Israel. We had a training mission with the Israeli Special Forces over there for 6 weeks or something like that. And I got in the email, I got this letter saying you're accepted, you know, and that was in October or November and school was starting. I started in a spring semester. So school was starting in January. So I was like, all right, this is it. So I went out there. I literally had terminal leave. I never took leave when I was in for the most part. I mean, I took sometimes, but I had like 78 days of leave saved up. So you can take terminal leave, they call it. You basically get out 78 days early, still get paid, you know, active duty through all of it, but you take your leave, you know, way ahead of time. Cause my actually date of getting out of the Army was like March 30th or something. But instead I left for Texas like January 8th, you know, and I drove from Colorado Springs down to Austin. First day of school is the next day. And the day after that was the first day of tryouts. And so I just kind of went to try. And as you know, like in college, at least these days, tryouts, you're not in pads and a helmet and anything like that. It's conditioning. I mean, they're going to see who is going to come out here on the scout team, you know, for 2 hour long practice and have no problem getting run over with dignity over and over and over and get up and keep your mouth shut and just get back in there and get run over again, you know? And I was cool with that. So I walked on initially as a receiver. And then day one of practice moved over to safety because Blake Gideon, who's a really good friend of mine, he's now a defensive back coach at University of Texas. He was a starting safety at the time. And he's like, look, your best shot. I mean, he saw the writing on the wall and the lack of athleticism. He was like, your best shot's going to be special teams. So why don't you come play safety? You know, a lot more of us are on some of the special teams. So I did, you know, went over to the safety room, was on the scout team for that year. And the next season, the starting long snapper was graduating and so was the backup. And so I just started long snapping, like just started messing with it. Cause I was like, man, I got to find a way on the field. I mean, I got to run down on kickoff coverage in one game because we were blowing out Texas Tech and it was like Veterans Day and all that stuff. And it was awesome. I mean, I was nowhere near the tackle, but you know, I, I threw a dude down, like the bench went crazy. And I was like awesome. So hyped. I was like, I gotta get on the field. So so I started long snapping. I went back overseas that summer because I was still in the Texas National Guard when I was in college. Went back overseas, went to Afghanistan that summer, brought a couple footballs with me. Any downtime I had, just like in the prior deployment to Iraq, I was training, you know, and I was long snapping like at least 30 minutes a day, if not more. Started to get the spiral down, started to get the accuracy down, trying to work on my velocity. That was the biggest issue. Came back, you know, went to in preseason training camp, and I won the backup job. So first game of the year, I'm the backup. And they had recruited a kid to come in and do it, you know, and he was a freshman. And, you know, there's 101,000 people, it was like more than that now. But at the time, there's 101,000 people in Texas Memorial Stadium. It's nerve wracking, you know, and he didn't have a great first game. And so I got an opportunity the next week and started for 38 straight games after that until I graduated.
Let's take a moment for one of our sponsors. The daily vitamins and supplements I've been using for optimization each and every day are those from BrainMD. Go to brainmd.com and use code ERIC15 at checkout for 15% off.
Man, that's an incredible story. I love that you brought those footballs over to Iraq. Like, yeah. I think about like what we complained about in college, like in the summertime, and you're bringing footballs over to Iraq to practice in the summertime.
Well, I volunteered to go. A and B, honestly, I enjoyed it. Not just because I enjoyed doing my job, but it helped continually give me that dose of perspective that I needed. And I still need it. I probably need it again today. I'm falling back into this comfortable, you know, place of fortune that we have here. You know what I mean? But it definitely it definitely helped with that. And I love the dichotomy of, you know, and the juxtaposition or whatever you want to call it of like going to this beautiful, you know, Austin, Texas and the green grass or the practice field and all these things, then going to Afghanistan where it's just completely different, you know, but also important what we're doing. And I always felt like maybe is sort of a fantasy of mine, but it's like, maybe I'm giving somebody a break by being here that has not had a break. Like I only deployed 3 times, right, to a war zone. Like there's people that deployed 13 times to a war zone, you know, from the global war on terror. So it's like, in those terms, I was like, you know, maybe at least I'm taking a slot, somebody that's got a family that, you know, has been going back to back to back to back for the last 10 years and needs a break.
Yeah, that's incredible perspective. Really mature of you at the time to think like that as well. Like, hey, I can still be a force for good. And
I'm like older than you at that time. I was like 32.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Regardless, it's still incredible perspective. And then we'll drop the Texas football thing. But as you were talking about that long snapper at the University of Texas, like I have buddies that played at UT, like that are from Texas. And I know like growing up, that's all they wanted to do. I'm sure this long snapper came to the University of Texas and was like, this is my lifelong dream. He blows it. And he's like, this military dude comes in, he's been training overseas, takes my job. And where did he end up? Did he end up transferring?
No, he didn't. He hung in there. You know, and he's a good guy. And I mean, at the end of the day, like, and he ended up starting the year after I left. So he did start for a year there after I left. At the end of the day too, like to make it at any position is really hard, but there's only one long snapper on every NFL team. So like, and they play forever. Those guys will play for 15 years, you know? So I don't know what the numbers are, but I'd guess maybe 2 a year, you know, from college actually become the new, a starting long snapper on a roster. So it's just such a tough deal. And I honestly did feel like kind of bad for the situation, but at the end of the day, like it comes down to, you know, not only the coaches have faith in and all that, but like the players too. And I think my background, it helped, you know, and it also helped getting that opportunity to play. I felt like I earned having a bit of a voice in the locker room where even though with my background, I just felt a little bit weird if I wasn't playing, that there was an expectation that I'd be a leader in the locker room, especially on game day. It's like, I'm not out there with you guys. You know what I mean? I'm in pads, but I'm looking clean because I'm not getting run over out there. So, and even though, you know, long snapping, it's not like you're playing middle linebacker or something like that, but you know, it's 12 to 15 plays a game. And at least you're out there at some level, and it is an important job and all that. So it helped cement more of a leadership role that I know a lot of people expected me to have, but I felt personally like it wasn't my job until I was playing meaningful snaps, you know?
Yeah, that's really cool. And everybody always forgets about the long snapper until one gets hurt or one stinks at the football game. Then everyone knows who the long snapper is. But okay, so you go to the Seahawks, short stint there, but you get a stint in camp, which gives you, you know, the credentials. You are now a former professional athlete. You were in a Seahawks uniform in the preseason. So that being said, you transition out of the NFL. We mentioned Jay Glazer before with his gym, Unbreakable, out in LA, which I love Jay. Jay's one of like the realest people I've ever spent time with. His language at a dinner is hysterical because he's so loud and he doesn't care. He is who he is. And everyone knows who he is too. And it's just hysterical to me, but I absolutely love Jay. I love the platform that he's using now too, to impact the mental health community the way he has and being vulnerable. And it's just a further reminder that when you're vulnerable and you'll show people weaknesses in life, you can often have way bigger of an impact than if you show them your cars and your money and how you have everything together in this perfect family. So Jay's done a great job with that. But you guys co-found Merging Vets and Players. Talk about how that got started and the impact you've seen from that.
Yeah, I mean, that literally got started as soon as football ended for me. I mean, I came back and you know, like you said, it was a great opportunity. I played one preseason game, you know, it's Lumen Field now, but it was called CenturyLink Field at the time. The Seahawks stadium, the fan base, you know, the 12s. And just that team. I mean, it was at the time, it was Marshawn Lynch and Richard Sherman and Russell Wilson and Bobby Wagner and Cam Chancellor and Michael Bennett and Jimmy Graham and Doug Baldwin. I mean, it was crazy, like just a squad, you know?
Right.
And all those dudes were, that locker room was very tight. And you know, I'd heard stories about the NFL, like, oh, you know, it's different. It's a business compared to college. And it is. I get that. But I think the way Pete Carroll and Mack Brown both sort of coached their teams, the positivity that they kind of maintain, the importance of fun and doing it for one another, you know, all about the guy on your left and right. It's contagious and it, you know, it breeds success. I mean, they won a lot of games, you know?
Right.
And that team was just fun. It was fun to be around. It was fun. Just the short 5 months I was there from, you know, OTAs and off-season training camp and the preseason was something I'll never forget, man. Treasure greatly. But I get cut, I head back to Los Angeles where I had trained with Jay at Unbreakable before I went to Seattle. And, you know, I was 34 years old at the time. I was not sure what I was going to do next. I was interested still in the film and TV stuff, like I had been 15 years before. Now I'm back in LA, so maybe that makes sense. But I'm also like, I mean, maybe I go back in the military, like I could do that. Or maybe I just keep training for football and see if I get another shot. But at the same time, like I am 34 and I'm undersized. I just started playing this game 5 years ago. I'm a good long snapper, but there's a lot of good long snappers. And there's a lot of good young long snappers that are a heck of a lot bigger and younger than I am. And so I was just kind of at this weird crossroads, and Jay approached me with this idea because he'd heard me on the phone talk to some of my buddies, you know, from the military, you know, that I served with before, that were just trying to figure out, proud of me for what I had accomplished, but also figure out like, how did you figure that out? How did you kind of make that transition? And it's kind of weird to hear that stuff from people that you know are elite, because in my mind I was like, I mean, I didn't know anything, I just tried, like I just went for it, you know. And if I didn't make it, which I eventually didn't, I mean, at some point you fail, it's all good though. I did everything I could and I took it as far as I could possibly take it, and the results aren't always up to us, you know. And I'm like, but I'll be honest with you right now, like the things you're saying to me, like that's how I feel right now. Now football's over. I lost that locker room. I lost the military locker room. I don't really feel like I have one either, you know? So I don't know. Like, we got to figure this out together though. And Jay was like, dude, I have that same conversation with football players all the time. Fighters, you know, they leave the cage, they leave the field. Coaches, you know, they get fired. Right. And it's like, all of a sudden they're hitting Jay up like, what do you think I should do? Like, all I know is this, you know, I know this world. I know the military world. I know the football world. I don't know anything else. And the reality is, like, we get wrapped up so much in that identity of the uniform that, you know, society tells us you're a football player, you're a veteran, that's who you are. And we start to believe it, you know, and that's all that we are. I mean, that is a part of who we are, but that's all that we are. And so Jay was like, let's bring these two groups together because they are unique and similar in the sense of both those careers end pretty young, you know, 20s and 30s. They're very, very intense. They're very physical in nature. I mean, especially the combat sports, you know, of course, it's not life and death for the most part, except for a few tragedies. It's not life and death on a football field or in, you know, or fighting, but like, it is very much, it's very challenging. It's very hard. You have to sacrifice a lot to be elite at your sport. And veterans look up to athletes and athletes look up to the military. There's this mutual respect and kind of an understanding that not a lot of other groups have. We're not the only ones, you know, of course we're not like, it's not like we're better than or so different that no one will understand us outside the walls of MVP, but we do have sort of that a unique similarity and kind of get each other, you know what I mean? And can talk through stuff in similar ways. And he's like, let's get them together and we'll just train together, you know? He's like, I don't really know what we're going to do. And I'm like, I don't know either, but that's a good idea. So I met some veterans right around that time down at there was a homeless shelter in Los Angeles on Sunset Boulevard in East Hollywood. And this veteran shelter, the shelter was all veterans, 48 they call it the barracks, 48 bunks, always full. And it's like a transition housing spot, right? Most of these people came from a really tough situation before they joined the military. They ran to the military, you know, to find a family in some ways, you know, I mean, a job. They wanted to be able to pay for college one day. Like, and then what they found was a sense of purpose and this like attachment to service and, you know, did some pretty incredible things. And then also lost a lot, you know, a lot of them were in units like 2-7 from the Marine Corps, which is probably the most represented unit in MVP, where they lost 29 guys on back-to-back deployments and they've lost 56 from that unit, from that battalion to suicide since. Like, wow. It's crazy, you know? So coming back from that and trying to, and people are like, thank you for your service and all this stuff, which is, it's appreciated, but feeling like you don't feel like a hero. You know what I mean? You feel like you all you can think about is those that you didn't save, you know, instead of like remembering that you did a lot of good stuff over there. And there's a lot of people in Iraq, Afghanistan, for instance, that you helped, you know. It's hard to remember that. It's hard to see that and feel that. And I think athletes, you know, they're so scrutinized in the media publicly. You can have an incredible career and you make, you know, one play and you're remembered for that play. It's a bad play. And it's like, you're that guy, you know what I mean? Or you're the coach that made that call or whatever it is. And it's brutal and it's hard to like get past that. And that's what you remember. You don't remember, you know, the wins. we're not wired that way. So we started bringing up these vets from the shelter. And Jay's bringing in like Tony Gonzalez and Randy Couture, you know what I mean? And it's like, you get these people in the room and they're just like, they could not be more different, you'd think, but they're exactly the same, you know, and they're talking about the same stuff. A story Tony Gonzalez is telling about how after his 17-year Hall of Fame career, he felt like he didn't have a home, you know, and like he didn't belong and he peaked. You know, and he's like, I'm not even 40 yet. And I've peaked. Like, what? I'll never be great again. What? And these vets are like hearing this and they're like, I actually relate to that so much. And so it was just kind of crazy how it organically all started. And so Now we've got 8 chapters around the country. We just opened in Phoenix recently. Otherwise, we're in LA, Las Vegas, Chicago, Atlanta, New York, and Seattle and Dallas. And then, you know, the movie, the MVP movie, it's about that story. That story of those vets from that shelter, specifically one, a Marine that's like a composite character from a couple of guys. And he meets an NFL player, first year out of the league, played 11 years, bounced around different teams, a lot of injuries, never had a winning season. So what does he hear? You know, oh, that guy's a bust. He was a bust, even though he's a first round draft pick. Right. You know, what a failure. And it's like, all of that was out of his control. He did everything he could. You know, he's played his butt off. You can't help so many things, you know, but what he hears is what he starts to believe. And he meets this vet the same way, you know, this Marine veteran. It's like, I couldn't save anybody. I couldn't. And now I'm back home and I got my buddies taking their own lives. I can't even save them. I can't do anything right. Like I, you know, what's the point? And, you know, the intent in the film, I don't want to spoil it, but like, they go on this journey together and it's not easy because they don't see eye to eye on everything, you know. But the mission is to ultimately save one another, you know, and that's the mission of MVP, Emerging Vets and Players, the organization. So it's been really cool. I mean, it is really cool. We're still growing. And I mean, that's how it really started, though. It was literally just Jay on a phone with one guy, me on a phone with another guy, having the same conversation with two people from completely different worlds.
Man, that is so incredibly powerful and so valuable for so many. I've had so many former professional athletes that come on here and they say, what I miss the most is the locker room, the camaraderie. I've had so many military members that have come on here since getting out of serving our country and say, you know, well, you miss that camaraderie. And even though you're not in the best conditions, like you're having fun, you're playing cards. I got a kick out of you saying earlier, you're playing Call of Duty. I'm just imagining how good someone with a military background could be.
I'm not good at it, but the guys on my team were. I'm terrible at video games, but they were good.
But so impactful for what you're doing. And for me, in putting out this book, if it helps one person out there in transition, then that's a win, because so many of us have struggled with transition and not all of us are lucky to have a Jay Glazer to connect the dots with us to form a new community, or myself, just the people I was blessed. You know, I got out of the NFL and I had this career-ending injury, and it was, you know, a small period of woe is me, but my son was born 50 minutes after I found out that my career was over. Well, I have this healthy son. My parents gave birth to a child with severe cerebral palsy that passed 11 years later. And every single day they were managing nurses in and out of the house, and Evan never walked or talked or breathed on his own. So you can get in that period, but then finding some perspective, you know, in a marriage, a support group, whatever it may be, everybody poured into me. And so those lessons I love to share with others, because I was just felt fortunate that I don't know why I'm so lucky to have been given all this and make my transition easier than so many others that struggle. But that was the point behind the book. And so anything I can ever do to support that community, please let me know, because similar to us meeting with Joe Jonas in Louisville, or us, you know, passing at the Rich Eisen studio, I just feel like God's kind of connected the dots in our lives here. But let me ask you just a couple of recurring questions and I'll get you out of here. I want to be respectful of your time. Do you have a favorite book?
Man. You know what? Like I would say my favorite book, it's just a good book. You know what I mean? Generally, it was East of Eden. It's a Steinbeck novel. I read it when I was in the Darfur, and I was just at that time of my life, you know, and it's the story of this family in California, you know, way back when, I think early 1900s. And it's just a sort of an epic, you know, novel of a very like, quote unquote, kind of normal family in a tough time in America, you know, and sort of just getting through it. And I say that because I'll be honest, I'm not a big reader. Don't read a ton. Read a lot of scripts. Right. So I'm more like the favorite movie guy, you know, but But that book, it's just always kind of stuck with me because I read it in 3 days and it's like, it's one of those, you know what I mean? It's a thousand pages or whatever. Because I just was like sucked into this world, you know what I mean? But there's a lot of, books. I mean, I love James Michener books. I don't know if you ever read James Michener books, but he takes a place and tells the whole history of this place, like from how the islands were formed in Hawaii to, you know, the people living there today. And it's like, it's all woven together over hundreds or thousands of years, you know? So yeah, that's a great, I need to think on that. That's a good question. That's a tough one. Cause I'm going to get that asked that again at some point.
Yes, you
but
are.
I would say, I mean, the one that pulled me in, I love Steinbeck. I love Hemingway, you know, kind of those old school writers. Those definitely resonate with me.
Yeah. And it's like, it pulled you back to an impactful moment in your life, like books, movies, podcast, you know, like sometimes you can put a place to it. What was your first car?
My first car was my dad's, it was a hand-me-down 88 Ford F-250, I believe, with a long bed. It was impossible to park. Yeah. And I'm living in the Bay Area in California. But my dad, as I mentioned before, my dad's a racehorse veterinarian. So he had they have like a refrigeration pack that's in the bed of these trucks, you know, and that's where all the medicine is for everything he's doing with the horses. And so I remember them, like, I had to drive it to this place. It's like crane, like pulled out the thing, you know, and it's like, now I got my truck. Probably got about 8 miles a gallon on that bad boy. But back then gas was like $1 a gallon, so no big deal, you know. But yeah, that was the first that pickup truck. That's what I had for, you know, at least a little while there in high school. And I think after that we ended up getting a more of a pride and joy car for me. Was it was a 1985 Jeep CJ7. You know, so, and now I have I have like a 90, I can't remember if it's 92 or 94 Wrangler with the square headlights that I drive around now. You know what I mean? So I'm always just driving simple, you know, pretty inexpensive vehicles. But it started back then and it's going to continue, I think.
Yep. All right. Two more for me. I lied on the couple. You have so much going on, but it doesn't seem overwhelming to you. Do you have like a specific morning routine that gets you started just to attack each day?
No, I don't have a specific morning routine necessarily. I try to get as much sleep as I can. And the schedule is kind of crazy these days, working on a lot of different film projects and stuff like that. So sometimes you're going to bed at 4 a.m. and sometimes, you know, you get to go to bed at 10 p.m. And whatever it is, I'm trying to get, you know, can I get 6 hours in? Can I get 7 hours in? Whatever that is. Always coffee. I'm a big coffee guy. I need to, just the smell of it. You know what I mean?
I'm with
you. Smell of it is enough for me sometimes. So get that coffee in. I need to get back into the routine of getting some exercise in early in the morning, because I used to do that. Like when I would get up, it's like, get the coffee and go work out, because you don't know if you're going to get another chance to do it today. You think you will, you know, you're like, oh, I got that hour blocked there. And then all of a sudden that hour, something fills in there. So no, I'm not, you know what? I think that kind of speaks to my personality. I'm not a super, surprisingly to a lot of people, because of the military, I'm not a super regimented person or routine person. Like, I never want to eat at the same restaurant twice. I don't like backtracking. So I like going a different way. You know, maybe that's partly PTSD. And you drive somewhere in Iraq, you never take the same road home for obvious reasons. I think it's more that I just like to see different things and kind of experience different things. So even with the type of exercise or, you know, the type of coffee or whatever I'm waking up, like, I kind of want to be a chameleon a bit to where I'm at and experience like what I'm, you know, what's there to experience that I don't know about. But also, like, yeah, my routine is literally not having a routine, not being regimented. And I kind of had that same mentality in the military, which is a little bit contrary, you know, but at least with my own personal stuff, you know,
right.
There's a time and a place where you have to do things a certain way. But that's just sort of how I am. I think it keeps me on my toes and I just enjoy it. I love different cultures and meeting new people and, you know, having a conversation like we're having today, like learning about you, you know, I mean, we we met, bumped into each other a couple of times. We don't really know each other though.
Right.
You know, I mean, I love that.
Yeah, me too. That's the beauty of the podcast space. I often say that I'll have a 30 to 60 minute conversation with somebody and learn more about them than I did in the previous 10 years, because you can direct the conversation to learn specific things about someone and really learn how someone's wired. But this is What's Next with Eric Wood. What's next for Nate Boyer? What's any new projects coming down the line for you?
Well, we need to recruit Eric Wood as part of our MVP team, first of all.
Yep.
which is great. So we'll follow up on that off the pod, man. But so beyond the movie, which, you know, the movie's out right now, on November 11th on Veterans Day, MVP, the movie, will move to streaming where people can, you know, watch it video on demand and other places. But there's also opportunities. This has been something that's really cool. People can watch this movie in theaters in their own city. Like, they set it up, you know, through, we have through our vetsandplayers.org, through our MVP website. You can not only donate to MVP, the charity, and reach out to us, but you can also connect with the film and screen it wherever you live. To set that up, all you got to do is, like, you know, rally your community and kind of get X number of people to buy a movie ticket. The movie will come there. And in certain situations, as many as I'm able to, like, I'm coming out and presenting the movie and hosting it, because we want to spread the message of MVP to as many places as we can. And those screenings will be available for people for at least the next 6 months, if not longer. So I encourage people to do that, engage with the movie if they can. Beyond that, coming at, it'll be probably around July. I think I'm going to do a little Shark Week special with Discovery Channel. And at a Shark Week, I hosted a show we finished shooting about a month ago down in Panama. That is a, can't spoil too much about it, but it's a competition series. And it's really interesting. It's very, very interesting. It brings That's together cool. people from very different walks of life, and tests them in some pretty in, you know, mentally, emotionally, obviously physically as well. But that's a fun show. So there'll be more to follow on that, but that's like later this year. And then I just want to make more movies. You know, I'm in Houston right now, cause we're working on a follow documentary with the University of Houston football team, kind of like Last Chance U type thing. Working on a baseball documentary called 20K about the four pitchers in Major League history to throw 20 strikeouts in a game. I just love telling stories and being a part of the things that I'm passionate about.
Right.
You know, I love sports. I think sports is such an incredible window to people, you know, and it brings people together, you know, it really does. And so, I'm probably working a little too much right now, but I don't want to lose momentum, and it's what I love, you know, and it comes with sacrifices in other parts of your personal life, which is very hard, you know, but I think I'm hopefully getting to a place soon that I can kind of get a production company going and pass off some things, you know what I mean? So I don't have to feel like I have to do everything myself. That's something that I struggle with, you know. It's like I got to push the button myself, and trying to let go of that is very hard, you know.
Yeah.
If it's your baby, you know, you're passionate about it. I'm sure I'm not a father, but I imagine there's those moments where you're like, man, I just want to show you the right way. But at some level, you got to let people find that out on their own as well. So,
yeah, no doubt about it. Well, I can't thank you enough for your time. As busy as you are right now, to bless me and this audience with your time means the absolute world to me. People, go out and support all of Nate's work, whether it's donating to the organization, whether it's going out and seeing the movie, purchase those tickets, bring them to your city out there. I can't thank you enough again for the time, for the impact you make. I knew this was going to be good. Your perspective and just your wide array of experiences absolutely fascinated me. We'll have to do this again at some point down the road, because there's like 15 follow-ups to many things you answered. I mentioned the Call of Duty one again, but I'm just like a mental note taker throughout this entire process. And brother, you're interesting, but man, the impact that you're having out there, I'm incredibly proud of you.
Thank you so much, Eric. I appreciate that, brother. I appreciate what you're doing too. For all you guys out there, if you don't have it yet, go tackle What's Next.
Yes, sir. I appreciate that. This episode has been brought to you by Jordan Yoakum at Tom James Company. Jordan is my clothing guy, and I get everything from him, from custom suits and dress clothes to casual wear. Let Jordan do the shopping for you to save you precious time that could be focused on your family, career, or hobbies. Jordan can work virtually with anyone in the world, and if he cannot personally get your measurements himself, he will have someone come get them for him. If you have put on the quarantine 15 like many have and your clothes aren't fitting properly anymore, he can also make adjustments to the clothing you already have. There's a certain confidence that comes with having clothes that fit perfect, and let Jordan give you that confidence. You can contact him by email at jordan.yoakum@tomjames.com or visit his website, LouisvilleCustomClothing.com. Contact info will be in the show notes.